Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 12:48 p.m. and that is Pacific Standard Time. Today is February 20th. I thought we'd kick off today with gold. It is up another $8.50 in here today and continuing to extend its breakout from the most recent short-term range. The base formation that persisted for approximately 6 years has been completed. We've had the first consolidation following the breakout, and now it has broken on the upside once more, mild consolidation, and is now extending what it has the appearance of a medium-term bull market. Obviously, the $1,600 area was something that represented an area of support back in 2011 and 12, and it hasn't really represented an area of resistance on this occasion. The peak value from back in 2011 of $1,911 is something that's ingrained in people's minds. And the fact that the price has rallied really quite impressively over the course of the last 18 months, going from under $1,100 to $1,600, and that's a big move by any instrument, although when we look at some of the returns we've seen in some asset classes over the course of the last 18 months, then we've seen incredibly outsized gains. There is obviously a race going on right now to try and lock down assets. And that's, I think, something that we need to be aware of, that there are a number of factors that are moving in tandem with one another to support this momentum move that we're seeing in stock markets. But perhaps chief among those is competitive currency devaluation. And that is one of the reasons why gold is doing so well, not simply in US dollars, despite the fact that the US dollar has been one of the strongest currencies anywhere. Gold is appreciating against it. It is also hitting new highs in a dynamic fashion against weaker currencies. The kind of move we've had, for example, in the Australian dollar, completing a 7-year base formation or range in 2018, and subsequently this very impressive move is just a testament to the fact that it was the Australian dollar was so weak during that time frame. Then we have this consistent long-term trend against the Brazilian real, and gold is trending very strongly against it. Another commodity-related currency, the Canadian dollar, is also trending lower against gold when we look at the Chinese renminbi. Well, the renminbi closed weaker than 7 in here today, and it is now within approximately 1,000 yuan of the peak from back in 2011. We can clearly see that there is a shared commonality between the trend that we have in US dollar terms and in renminbi. The fact that the trend against renminbi is more advanced does tell us a lot about the weakness of the renminbi over the course of the last 3 or 4 years. And I do think that there is a significant potential here that we're going to see new all-time highs in renminbi terms. Another major consumer of gold, India, is seeing gold trending higher and at new all-time highs. And that is despite the fact that the Indian rupee has been among the steadiest currencies in Asia over the course of just the last few months. Gold is also breaking on the upside against the Japanese yen. Now, if we start to look at some of these currency charts, and not just simply measuring them against gold, but against the dollar, this has been a dynamic rally by the US dollar in yen terms. And it is in the process of breaking the sequence of lower rally or major rally highs that's been in evidence since 2015. Japan is experiencing the double whammy of having raised consumption taxes for a third time in the space of the last 6 or 7 years. It's having the predictable result of hitting consumption. But they picked almost exactly the wrong time to introduce it, at exactly the same time as China is experiencing a growth hiatus as a result of the lockdown resulting from the coronavirus, or the attempts to contain the coronavirus. And that is putting downward pressure on the yen. It's also boosting demand for carry trades. Then when we look at the Chinese renminbi, then we also have evidence here of the dollar breaking a sequence of lower rally highs. In fact, if we zoom in and just simply look at the technicals, that is an upside weekly key reversal. We've had upside follow through, and it is following through again now. And this would suggest that we have seen a low of medium-term significance for the US dollar. So I think that's rather important as well. But it is the knock-on effect that that is having on regional currencies is, I think, equally important. The Asia dollar index has now broken its sequence of higher reaction lows, and it is coming back down again, and this does look like a pronounced period of weakness. I think we have to zoom out and look at plenty of back history in order to really get a perspective on where the lows could be. Back in 2008, they were approximately around where the price is trading right now. Back in 2001, well, they were significantly below where they are today, and there is a clear downward bias to trading. There isn't a real, I think we would need to see a clear, or some clear evidence of a higher reaction low, clear upward dynamics, a sustained move above the trend mean, and a break in that, and certainly a move back above the peak value for January in order to really confirm that Asian currencies aren't going to continue to trend downwards. That's a laundry list of conditions that would have to be met, and we're just nowhere near that right now. So then when we look at, for example, the Korean won, I think the long-term chart for the Korean won gives us a lot of very interesting data because it's a very well-defined base formation. Now, there have been failed moves above the $1,200 area for the dollar over the course of the last 10 years, but it does look better supported around this level on this occasion. We're only 2 won short of the 1,200 point level right now. There is the clear potential that we're going to see the South Korean won breaking lower. The Thai baht had been among the strongest currencies in the region and had spent much of the last few years trending stronger against the dollar, but it now has clearly the dollar has clearly broken back above the trend mean and is moving in a dynamic manner. The Singapore dollar is also under some pressure here, although it wasn't I was off its lows in here today. But again, I think it is really imperative to look at as much back history as one can possibly get in order to really get a perspective on what exactly is going on here. Because the Singapore dollar trended higher and in a very persistent manner between about 2001 and 2011. And then the dollar put in a base formation and broke out. And this entire range over the last 5 years could easily be a first step above the base. So there is obviously some pricing in of a deleterious outcome to Chinese growth going on in a number of these Asian currencies. And I think that is one of the biggest takeaways here. We did have some additional questioning of Chinese data on the coronavirus in here today. And when we look, for example, at the Taiwanese dollar and the reliance that South Korea and Taiwan and Japan have on Chinese growth to boost demand for exports, I think the Taiwanese dollar starting to weaken now from the 30 area is, I think, probably also very much in line with the kind of weakness we've seen in the Korean won and the Singapore dollar. But the trend for the Taiwanese dollar has been much more of a peg relationship rather than the kinds of trends we've seen in other currencies. Now, when we think about what's exactly going on in China, they've quarantined about 50 million people. They've put about 500 million people on lockdown. They don't know how many infected people they have because they're not measuring it. And of course, the difficulty is that the incubation period for the coronavirus is 2 weeks. The only way to know that someone hasn't got it is to quarantine them for 2 weeks and then ensure that they don't come into contact with anyone who does have it in the subsequent period. And that is just not practical with when you're talking about hundreds of millions of people. This insistence on getting people to wear face masks and taking temperatures is a complete waste of time when it comes to policing how people can move around. This is not something that is just going to go away overnight. It's going to require a really quite considerable effort to try and contain. And the more understanding that we get from it, and the more expertise that healthcare professionals have in treating it, I think that there is the potential that the Chinese may decide to just let it go, and that they will take the hit in terms of treating the most acutely affected people and just let everybody get it because they know that the vast majority of people are not going to have a deadly infection and that most people's reaction is quite mild. Well, if they do in fact do that, then the chances of it becoming a global pandemic and affecting the healthcare systems of every country is obviously going to ramp higher. Now, that does suggest that the potential for additional stimulus is obviously going to trend higher. So when we start to think about competitive currency devaluation, we're seeing the clear evidence of that coming through in Asia. But then we also have to look at the continued downtrend we're seeing in the euro. This has been a very pronounced decline. So from a stock market perspective, when the euro has tended to decline, it has acted as a boost to the nominal value of the euro stocks. And when we think about the performance of the euro stocks or the euro stocks 50, where they've bounced from the region of the trend mean or the DAX index, which is total return, so includes dividends, pushing on as well. And I should, sorry, this is these are not the right charts. I forgot to put local currency back in. So let me put those back up again. The Euro Stoxx index has bounced from the region of the trend mean and pushed new highs. The DAX has done the same thing. The Euro Stoxx and the Europe Stoxx is pushing through the 400 level. Now, when we look at a US dollar denominated European ETF, then that gives us perhaps a more, I think, objective view of how well it has done. So it is still ranging. When we look at it in US dollar terms, it is going up, and the support that it gets from the weakness of the euro is certainly helping to support the values. But it isn't hitting the same kind of new highs in dollar terms as the Nasdaq is, for example. Now, we've seen a really quite spectacular rally over the course of the last few months, and it is really quite overextended on the upside. And more to the point, the speed with which the index has been rallying is faster than we've seen at any point in the course of the last decade. And we have ample evidence of acceleration in a significant number of large companies. So the phenomenal move we've seen in Tesla, for example, that does appear to be one of the clearest signs of speculative interest. But what I find particularly interesting is the confluence of various factors that are going on right now. So 10-year yields are at 1.5%, and coming back down to the lows put in August and October. But it's a bearish looking chart, and there is the potential here that we're going to see additional compression in yields. When we look at the yield curve, for example, for the Eurozone, the vast majority of yields going all the way out to 10-year maturities are in negative territory, and even the 30-year only has 4 basis points on the upside, or to the positive. So not only is the euro declining, but there is the potential to lend, to borrow at extraordinarily low levels. But what does a pension fund do? They have got expected returns to meet their liabilities of about 8%. And if they are buying bonds with a yield which is less than 2%, and in some cases very close to zero, how on earth are they expected to generate the kind of returns necessary to meet future liabilities? Well, they're all engaging in modern portfolio theory and factor investing. If you're only getting an expected return of 1.5% from your bond holdings, well, then that means that in order to balance the volatility and expected return of the portfolio, you have to go out and find something that has the capacity for a much higher return. And the only way to do that is to go further out on the risk horizon, or to go into alternative assets. It's that move into alternative assets has been, I think, the most profound change in terms of portfolio management over the course of the last decade. And because the vast majority of these assets are not publicly listed, then it's difficult for regular investors to monitor the quantity of money that has gone into venture capital and private equity. So the acceleration that we're seeing in Tesla is, I think, beneficial to investors, not simply because of the incredible acceleration that we've seen, but it is perhaps more like a barometer of the kind of interest that is moving into these highly speculative venture interests. Now, the rationale for doing that is that if you invest in enough of them, that the one or two that are successful will more than compensate for the loss that is taken on the ones that fail. But there has been a massive quantity of capital flowing into this sector. And the rationale that everyone is going to have the one or two highly successful companies that can compensate them for all of the duff trades is very tenuous when it's a crowded trade to begin with. So when we think about where the risks lie, then the risks are very clearly in the private equity sector. So that, I think, is one of the reasons why we need to monitor the trend we see, for example, in Tesla, or, for example, in Virgin Galactic. Again, Virgin Galactic has done spectacularly well, going from about 7 to 40 in the space of about 10 weeks, which is nothing short of stratospheric. That's really quite amazing in terms of the potential upside and the rush to try and gain a piece of these speculative ventures. What I think is particularly important to pay attention to is that these are not, or, well, I think the best way to characterize it is this is earnings agnostic investing. Why people are investing in these is because of their potential future return, rather than the earnings that they have today, or the strength of their balance sheets they have today. This is, I think, a testament to the kind of bubbly activity that we have right now. Now, what I find also particularly interesting is the continued advance we're seeing in the renewables sector. So the solar sector has been doing very well. The wind sector has been doing well. When we then look at, for example, some of the anything really relating to hydrogen has been doing really very well. The big point, though, is even when, I think this is perhaps one of the better examples. When we look at, for example, Albemarle Corp., the share was up in a pretty dynamic manner in here today, and this, it didn't quite hold all of the advance, but it's been a meaningful move since the beginning of December, going from about 65 to nearly 100 at the peak in here today. Now, when we then think about the fact that the lithium price has done pretty much nothing but go down over the course of the last 18 months, what is the rationale for why for all of the lithium miners turning the corner and starting to trend higher again? Well, we might conclude that investors believe that this downtrend in lithium prices is about to end, and some of the lithium miners have suggested that the lithium price will probably turn around in the second half of the year. But it could simply be because these are speculative ventures, and the potential return, if some of the most bullish forecasts come to fruition, are going to more than make up for the potential for loss in some, if not most, of the speculative ventures. Now, this kind of seat-of-the-pants investing and the extraordinary measures that highly conservative asset managers have to go to in order to generate the kinds of returns necessary to meet their obligations, because of the distorting effect of extraordinarily accommodative monetary policy and fiscal policy, well, this is blowing a significant bubble. So we do have the short-term potential for some pause and consolidation. I think that that is quite clear from the overbought conditions we have on Wall Street. But we also know that it is quite likely we're going to get a lot more monetary and fiscal stimulus. What I find also, that I think the parallels that we have right now between the period in 1998, when the yield curve first went inverted, and the eventual peak in 2000, I think it is particularly relevant to look at the dollar index around that time. When we go all the way back and look at how did the dollar index perform in the last few years of the technology-led bull market, well, it rallied spectacularly from similar levels to where we are today. The dollar was the strongest currency in the world at exactly the same time that the Asian financial crisis was affecting Asia, the Russian debt default was affecting Russia, long-term capital management was affecting the banking sector. All of that contributed to massive sources, or I guess let's just say that interest rates staying lower for longer than they probably should have, it effectively inflated a bubble in the technology sector, and that eventually popped. Well, the parallels that we have today and against the background where we're already starting to see accelerating trends, it is the base case that we are now in a bubbly environment and that momentum is still very much in the ascendancy. In fact, we're unlikely to see any real efforts to unwind the stimulus until we start to see any evidence of inflationary pressures. And that's unlikely with the potential for additional slowdown in China I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I wish all the best to all of you.